Inns. He's the founder and editor of Geez magazine, G-E-E-Z, which is based in Canada and includes the feature Life Offline. He's also the former managing editor of Adbusters magazine. And he's the originator, yes, he's the originator of Buy Nothing Christmas. So, Aidan Inns is going to speak to us about Life Offline.
Good morning. So I'm the editor and founder of Geez magazine, and just for your, I brought some extra copies for folks. I put a box with a few spares up here. Help yourself if you're so inclined. I don't feel like an expert in this company of panelists and speakers and many that I've interacted with. I don't mean to be too self-effacing, but I'm just an editor. And my role is to try to take the best information, the best insight, the best actions, the best stuff, and deliver it to an audience, a committed community of readers. You can see that my marketing strategy worked. Look at that. We're creating desire right here. That's how it works. So I'll continue. I do have some slides to show, but before I do, I just want to say I'm super excited to be here. I drove in our camper van with my partner Karen, 4.5 hours from our home in Winnipeg, Canada, to Fargo, North Dakota. Then we waited 5 hours, this was after midnight, to board the Amtrak train with a week's luggage and 50 pounds of magazines, which have now been dispersed, and I'm grateful for that. We rode 2 days eastbound. We changed trains in Chicago at Union Station. We happened to see, when we stepped off the train, a filming of a TV show, Chicago Fire. And then we waited in Albany, or as the person said, Albany. Oh, Albany! I don't know, I can't say it quite. Where the train literally split in two. They added in a car at the back to push our train into. One side went to Boston, the front half, and the back half went to Penn Station in town. So I drove and then slept. Two nights in a coach class to be with you here today. That's amazing, eh? This is a key part of my message. Each of us should pick something to mark us as a holdout against a toxic notion of progress. Pick something. 10 years ago, I vowed never to fly, except for family emergencies, and I have, when my mother had open heart surgery and later passed on, or died, or became dust. It's not so much that I'm afraid of flying, it's more that I'm afraid of what flying does to me. It lures me into the cult of speed. Efficiency is too successful at seducing me. For me, overland travel has become a burden. But it's a burden I've chosen to demonstrate the possibility of restraint to myself. It reorients me to the geography of the land. It's not a big deal, and yet it is. See, that's a paradox. I'm informed by faith, my Christian faith, but I also resonate with others, and paradox is really important. It, it sort of defies problematic logic. Now, something about my work as an editor. I see my role as an editor as one of bridge building. We need more people to hear the word that this conference has to offer. We need to broadcast suspicion and caution about technology for many reasons, and we've heard so many here, and I want to do my part in communication. We need to facilitate dialogue and provide avenues of action. And in addition to providing information for readers, we need to provide, as Ralph Nader did, at least for me last night, inspiration, a reason to care, and some tendrils of hope. At our magazine, we take on a task that is both prophetic and pastoral, and ambitious and perhaps arrogant. So now some slides. This year, we rewrote our tagline. We called it Contemplative Cultural Resistance. This is taken from the magazine. Contemplative because we need the inner strength to deal with the despair in and around us. We remember to sit, to dwell, and revel in the mystery of silence. We connect with a dimension bigger than our egos. There's something up there, actually, you know, like the trees, the people beside you, your neighbors. Also, ours is a cultural enterprise because the stories we tell govern our behavior. And I could say more about that, but I won't at this point. And finally, resistance for me, because I think this is the most important. Contemplative culture resistance. And this is to remind us as editors and hopefully readers and those of us who benefit from privilege, and I'm mindful of the privilege I bear in so many ways. This is to remind us not to be complacent in the comfort that we've inherited. Here we remember that those in power, government officials, commercial media editors, bosses who mistreat workers, men who degrade women, those in power smile upon us as we conform to patterns of oppression. Learning from the feminist theologian in Germany, Elisabeth Schussler-Fiorenza, learning from her teaching on kyriarchy, which includes patriarchy, we seek to confront all forms of power imbalance in solidarity with those who suffer. We'll explore environmental justice and animal ethics. We'll tell stories of civil disobedience, of folks who defy regulations that benefit the rich, white, capitalist, straight, male, and colonizing people, and those who disenfranchise those who are poor. People of color. And disenfranchise those who are poor, people of color, homeless, workers, queer, female, indigenous, disabled, young or old, and we as editors have lost one. Now, you probably got the impression by now that being a magazine editor is the most important thing you could ever do. Probably it is, but there are other things that are important as well. In fact, there is a whole spectrum of actors and people in different stations in this movement for social change. We created early on a catalog of social change, which includes those of the Vanguard and go on down the list. We happen to be part of the independent media, culture creatives, and contemplatives. And you should find your place and find kinship with others. And I resonated with what Ralph Nader said yesterday about left and right. I mean, I can go down here and I can see kindred spirits in this enterprise all over the place. Independent, non-commercial, eco-minded media is culture work. Culture, and this is a quote from Stephen Duncombe, who put together the Cultural Resistance Reader. Culture, this is again a quote, culture can be and is used as a means of social control. More effective than any army is a shared conception that the way things are is the way that things should be. But culture can be and is used as a means of resistance and a place to formulate other solutions. And that's our work. And so, I know it's kind of a dumb graphic, but we want to like really see we're doing work. My partner comes from a farming family, and I often feel like I'm not doing real work sitting at a computer, and in many ways I am not doing real work sitting at a computer. But so this is me, you know, working in my own mind and others in the image layer. We disturb the field of stereotypes. We plant seeds of liberation at best. We unlearn discrimination in images and problematic assumptions and offer new ways of seeing and telling stories. It's painful to see with new eyes. We gave this photo to readers in a color postcard, hoping they'd put it on their fridge or their bulletin board or their dorm room door. In the summer this year, in our offline Life Offline issue, which I just passed around a few spare copies, we said we'd remain primarily print. And I appreciate the words of Chet earlier about print. And there's some cautions there as well. We still use the web to promote the magazine, even support a community of readers, but the magazine itself can only be read as a physical object. And incidentally, if some of your insert crass ad here, if some of you regret that you don't have a physical object like G's Magazine to cherish, there's a few more at the table in the back. And also, and I'll get to the word of contradiction earlier, but let me just say in full contradiction, you can find us online. Sometimes you have to be amused at yourself. I certainly find that amusing. You can't get the whole thing online, but you can learn about it and then order it. And maybe it's another key to this. We're teasing people away from the internet. Or as Colin Lazin at AdBusters used to say, we're getting the media giant to bite its own tail. This is a letter that our designer got from his dad. It's a photograph of a letter now, a PowerPoint projection of a photograph. And you can sort of feel the tangibility of it. There's something nostalgic, something precious, and, oh, that's really me, something cherishable about it. Profiteers recognize this, but they also realize it takes so much time, and it's too effortful. Sometimes people have more money than time, and so they pay a company. They send a text, and then they have a robot that writes in beautiful handwriting, and beautiful is in quotes, beautiful handwriting, and then they fold it up and stuff in an envelope with a wax seal. See if you can do that. Even profiteers know the charm of the printed page and hear a corporation offers to write your electronic messages. This is a gentleman enjoying nature. In this case, a squished gopher. Technology is portrayed by mainstream media is a neutral friend. But we know, having heard Jerry Manley earlier and just using our intuition, I trust, that we know it's not just a friend and a source of happiness. Yes, it helps us enjoy nature, but we also enjoy it as we ruin nature in other regards. Portraying technology as innocuous raises haunting questions. And those questions, I hope, soften our hardness to change. So here we're kind of laughing at how I hope that readers think it's silly, you know, to do what he does, and I do that too because I'm silly. But then that hopefully disarms us a bit, and then we get asked the questions. That's part of the culture work. We published an article by Derek Jensen on how we look at animals. Some people think that this is nature, and he helped us understand that it's really a, not really liberty and happiness is depicted here. And what is our response? We seem to enjoy becoming like that which we've encaptured. Could it be that we, the captors, have become the captives? My answer is yes, but not entirely. The logic of the machine, as Chet just explained, is routine, inorganic, repetitive, profitable, and we participate in it. And here a word on hegemony or hegemony. We consent to our own repression. In part due to coercion, and this can be soft or hard, and if you have the underside of history, you will feel the hardness of coercion. If you have an onslaught of iPhones all around you, you will feel the soft part of coercion, and many of us feel that latter part. But there's a woman who said, and I'll repeat it, fuck legal. She has felt the hard part of coercion. And I just want to say it's all around us. I'm getting worked up here. This is supposed to be entertaining. We consent to our own repression in part due to coercion, which can be soft or hard, but also because of desires, our own desires. And they could be misplaced desires. And we in the magazine are explicitly engaged in counter-hegemonic discourse. This is a term that I use occasionally in the office, and I just receive boring looks from my coworkers. Anyway, so it's very ambitious, at least in my heart. This is a church, theater, stadium, in our town in Winnipeg. It's a techno-dazed mind. Glory is revealed with bursts of light, magnification on the screens. And here, in a room devoid of natural light, advanced humans worship their creator. And it gives me the creeps. I do identify as Christian, by the way, but not that kind of Christian. Cult of celebrity, society of spectacle, these are operative here. And at what point do the alienated begin to feel their disconnect? We need more than a change of heart. In addition, we need a change in collective behavior, as Bill McKibben said. Perhaps the most primary thing is structural change. Repentance is kind of a gross word if you have evangelical background, as I do. It's a relic from prophets of old, a call to those encrusted in a hard society to break open and reconnect with the land and with the vulnerable. These are all images from our magazine. We have a lot of Bible-based readers, and we're suggesting we need a word of liberation, and the motivation and courage to opt out of eco-decline and participate in rejuvenation. And here we have a word from the prophet, and as it quotes, the end is near, from the pseudo-scriptural text, Colossians. We have 14 reasons why we're offline. I'm not going to read them all to you. In fact, I'm going to skip to the end of my presentation, thanks to the bell ringer. And just read a word on board, because maybe that's part of our role as a somewhat spiritual magazine. There is a place available to us all where hope is not a central concern. You know, those of us in power want to figure it out and go somewhere and have hope. But it need not be a central concern. To feel the pulse of the earth as it responds to the sun is to know something beneath our emotions of hope and despair. A stream of vitality runs through all that is. And fortunately, we have access to that which flows. The animals may feel a long winter coming. The air may still tolerate our exhaust. The wind is losing patience. The water is confused. But the sun knows the secret power of birth and death and breath, knows there is nothing to fear. This is a religious conviction, to trust our irrational perception of a creative force around and within us, a force that is both gentle and indomitable. This life force infuses the dandelion and suggests a tilt toward the light. This life force remains open and available even to us humans, even as we become encrusted and hardened. This is a hard word for me to say, to look for hope. Is there one more after that? No? I'll just read a bit more now. To look for hope among human conduct is futile. But to feel for life in every breath holds deep reward. A citizen plants a garden that yields a handful of tomatoes. One is sweet to taste. A second is taken by the bugs. And a third is squandered against a wall. Does the vine despair? If the gardener can hear the whisper of the vine, even vandals are welcome to the fruit. This knowledge is useless, but sustaining. Ask an activist why she keeps at her task of providing food, consolation, policy improvements, water, medication, and her answer can only sound glib. To look for hope among human conduct is futile, but to feel a kinship with those who open up to generosity is to grasp something ineffable, and even inspiring. This is a process, not a product. This is living and breathing, nothing more. I offer a word to those who, like myself, were raised within a religious tradition, and this is my last two sentences. In my case, I came of age in Mennonite Christian soil. This soil is tainted with patriarchy, capitalism, and an embarrassing arrogance toward plants and animals. But I've discovered a spirit beneath the tradition, a spirit that's connected to everything. It emanates from the ancient saints of virtue and the volunteers in thrift store aisles. A trustworthy spirit exists in our midst. And I'm talking to something that I see in atheists as well, but maybe not call it the same thing. It will appear both futile and liberating, and it will be both dissident and exemplary, and it forgets to fret for hope. Thank you very much.